From the boardroom to the locker room, sport captures the imagination like little else. In this podcast, we talk to the men and women who make the big decisions and those who make the big plays to find out where sport is and, importantly, where it's going. But we do so through the only eyes that matter, those of the fan. Welcome, everybody, to another edition of Are You Not Entertained? Joining me, as always, is my partner in crime, the man in the lake, who we've all come to know and love, despite the fact he's a Scotsman, Roger Mitchell. Come in, Rog.
Hello, Grant. I'm fine. I'm absolutely fine. I'm not in the lake, but I should be. It's really hot here.
And, so you're just by the lake?
By the lake, sweating. I did, as you do, not as many as you, but I did a kind of one of these podcast webinar things. And it's hard work. I don't know how you do so many of these, Grant, with such quality, by the way, may I add. You're knocking it out of the park these days.
Oh, that's very kind of you, mate. That's very kind of you indeed. Yeah, I enjoy
it. Mike Green, honestly, I know it's not a finance podcast, but if I can shout out to anybody that listens to us and has got an interest in geopolitics, finance, and economics, listen to Grant's podcast with Fleckenstein and Mike Green. Don't pay for an MBA. Don't go to Harvard. Just listen to that for an hour and a quarter, maybe a wee bit more, and yeah, you're fine.
Yeah, it's look, Mike's an extraordinary guy, and that was an extraordinary conversation, even by his standards. And it's great. You know, the feedback's been brilliant, and people have really enjoyed it, which is great. That's why you do these things, right? So hopefully people enjoy them and more importantly, learn from them. And Mike's someone that I've learned a lot from over the years, so it's great to give other people the chance. But what we didn't talk about is sport, because we saved that for this, Rog. We've got
Mike knows nothing about sport, let's be honest.
His daughter's a good beach volleyball player. I think he knows more about sport than you would perhaps think, having listened to him talk
that's,
about
that's incredibly
finance and
intimidating
science and stuff.
That's incredibly intimidating. He knows everything, doesn't he? He knows it all.
Yeah, you wouldn't want to put yourself up against Mike in anything. I wouldn't even. He's probably got Scottish genes, so I wouldn't even go drinking with him for you. You just never know. But listen, the matter at hand, Rog, is goal on goal.
And it is.
I am going to be the perfect English gentleman. I'm going to let you go first.
Well, if you say English, I have to trump you with Scottish. And my little goal comes from one of our listeners, Derbyshire Phil.
Good old Derbyshire Phil.
Yeah, it's classic Twitter handle. He takes us back to a sport that many people have forgotten about now, snooker. This week, a Scotsman came out of nowhere, basically washed up, got into the tournament because somebody else dropped out, and ended up winning it. And of course, as he was going through the ranks of the draw, more and more people were commenting. And he got to the semi-final, and there was this chap that was playing, Judd Trump. You know, and we don't know any of these.
Judd Trump's a proper player.
I don't know any of these people anymore. I don't follow it that much. But Judd Trump was saying Maguire, the Scotsman, could have been one of the all-time greats in snooker, but didn't have the drive, didn't have the professionality. And of course, Maguire whacked him in the semi, and then went on to win the final. And it's just a little appetizer for the show. I thought that was lovely. It's a little bit like Denmark, you know, getting into the Euros at the last moment.
Yeah.
And then winning the tournament.
Yugoslavia got pulled out, didn't they, because of the war? That's right.
Yeah. So that's a little mini goal to kick us off. Thanks to Derbyshire Phil.
Nice. I hadn't seen that. You know, it's funny. When I was a kid, it's hard to believe it now, but I followed snooker voraciously. I mean, it was crazy. It was a huge sport.
Huge.
You know, I was a big Steve Interesting Davis fan, believe it or not.
No, you weren't.
No, I was. I mean, obviously, I appreciated Higgins and White and all the talent, but I was a Steve Interesting Davis fan. It's almost shameful to admit it, but now he's turned out in his sort of 50s and 60s to not be quite as boring as everybody thought it was. I'm okay with it.
Well, you know what?
Okay,
he is actually a lovely guy. I ran into him in the most bizarre of circumstances at a SoccerX conference about, 10 years ago. And, you know, at these conferences, they have, you know, certain breakout areas. And there they had a pool table where you could play snooker, pool with Davis. And they had darts where they had the guy that was the big champion at the time. Can't remember his name.
John Lowe or
Later than that, Phil Taylor. Phil Taylor was there in the darts and basically taking on all comers. So what are you going to do? You're going to walk past the table, Grant? Are you going to walk past
Of course not.
Right.
Of course not. You're going to put your 50p on the side and wait for your go, right? Sure.
Well, you know, I was there relatively early in the morning because, like, these things get very busy. So I wanted to check it out before everybody came. So it was relatively empty. But Steve Davis was there and he says, "You want a game?" You know, like, that's not one of the scenarios you imagine in life.
No.
You know, like, when.
Did he add the words for money?
No, I listen, so he was the nicest guy, and I tell you what, you know me, I'm relatively gallus, to use a Glasgow word. I don't kind of like get overawed pretty that easily. I could hardly hold the cue, Grant. I could hardly hold the cue, and, like, you know, he's obviously doing it, you know, still half asleep and with one hand reading the paper, and, you know, bang, bang, put it in. And like, I think he deliberately missed one. So I could get in, and
you think?
Yeah, and like this is the highlight. You know, like, players like me that can't play, sometimes you get a really thin cut and it just comes off and it goes in. You know, but you don't really know what you're doing. You know, good players get the straight ones. You know, 100 times out of 100, rubbish players can get the really difficult one out of 50. You know,
yeah.
And this went in. And he said, "That's a great shot." And, you know, like, I thought, that's it. There you go.
Cue dropped.
Thanks, Steve. Such a nice guy. So,
he does seem like a nice guy. Talking of thinking he gathered, did I ever tell you the story about my buddy and the Pro-Am tennis tournament?
No.
Oh, this is a great story. So a buddy of mine in Hong Kong, who shall remain nameless, was a very good junior tennis player, very good junior tennis player, nationally ranked. He was the number one ranked player in the southern half of his state, and number two in the state as a whole. I said, "Well, yeah, why are we only number two in the whole state?" He said, "Well, I just couldn't beat this guy who was in the northern half of the state." But he got to the US Open, Junior Open, and he drove with his girlfriend to the tournament. And they drive, you know, halfway across the country, and it's in Florida, I think, at the Bollettieri Academy or somewhere like that. And he breezes through the first couple of rounds, and he said he gets to the quarters or the semifinals, and he's playing some kid from California he's never heard of. And so this far, he's barely dropped a game, let alone a set. So he gets this thing, and he said, "We're warming up, and this guy is all over the place. He's just hopeless." And he said, "I'm just about to start, and I realised I've still got the car keys in my pocket, my shorts. I got to put the ball in the pocket, and realize that my car keys are in there." So I throw them to my girlfriend who's sitting in the front row, and I'm kind of joking with her and, you know, being a bit of a flash so and so. And as I throw them to her, I said, "You know, keep it running. This won't take long."
Oh no! Oh no!
And he said it. No, he said it. And he said it didn't take long. I lost 6-love 6-1 to Roscoe Tanner, a very young Roscoe Tanner. So he said I got blown off the court by
this
guy.
As you would by Roscoe Tanner. Yeah. Boom.
So, you know, this was obviously like 70s, right? Maybe early 80s, way back. So fast forward, you know, 30 odd years, maybe 40 years, and so my buddy's living in Hong Kong, and he plays in a celebrity pro-am tournament every year there, and they have a lot of big names come in. And he gets paired with Bjorn Borg one year as his partner. And so they're having fun, they cruise to the tournament, and I think the winning pro gets 10 grand or something. And they get to the semi-finals, and he's drawn against Roscoe Tanner and his partner. And he says to Borg, who had had his problems with his clothing company and he declared bankruptcy,
he
said, "Right, listen, I'll cover the 10 grand for tomorrow. I'll pay you that if we win this match. I just want to win this match. And then you've got your 10 grand. And if we win the final, you can have that as well. I don't care. I want to beat Roscoe Tanner." So he said, "We go on the court, we shake hands, we play the game." And sure enough, he and Borg beat Tanner and his partner. And as they're coming off the court, my buddy says to Roscoe Tanner, "Hey, listen, thanks for the game and stuff." He said, "You probably won't remember me, but we played as juniors." And Roscoe Tanner said, "I remember every game I've ever played." So my pal says to him, "All right, US Junior Open, 19, whatever, Florida." And Tanner, after about a second, says, yeah, I beat you 0-1 in the quarterfinals.
Oh.
And Phil goes, that's incredible. He said, yeah, I remember the game. And my buddy says, I've got to ask you one question that's been gnawing away at me for 40 years. He said, what's that? He said, did you let me win that game? And Roscoe Tanner said to him, yeah, I just wanted one more practice game on my serve before the final. Absolutely brilliant.
That's a great story.
Oh, it's fantastic. But to hear my pal tell it, it's just
cool. Oh, no, great.
Anyway, it's...
Let's digress a little bit more now that we've got into pressure. No, if you allow me, if you give me 5 minutes to digress into a story from my music days, you'll like this, I think. I don't think I've ever told you this. So when we went into Virgin Music after it had been bought by EMI, middle of the 90s in Italy, it was a really bad performer. And you know, they couldn't sell even the biggest albums. It was a dead creative business. And this guy came in, the new CEO, who was mercurial, Roman, genius, eclectic, kind of like Hugh Henry type guy. We removed a lot of the people. We had to change them. And there was this one guy who was always borderline, Grant. You know, like, he was on the kind of like product marketing promotion side. And he was always like a hair's breadth away from getting his jotters, you know? But he had one thing going for him that I think saved him. He had an incredibly verified reputation with the ladies. it was internationally famous. That he had a skill in this area, and he wasn't Brad Pitt, you know. He looked a bit like Tom Waits, you know. Like he was a type, you know. But he wasn't Rock Hudson, you know. And
more so, tar pit than Brad Pitt.
Yes. So we there was this night that Lenny Kravitz was playing in Milan, and the support act was this Texan girl band, bit of rock and roll because it was obviously the same as Lenny. But the four of them, they looked like the Cowboys cheerleaders, all of them, Grant. You know, all of them. And they were on before and after the concert. You go to a big restaurant, you get a big table, everybody's around, circular table. And these four from the Texans band were just stunning, absolutely stunning. And he was sitting beside me, and we were almost diametrically opposed from where these four, they were together, the four of them. And, you know, so the night goes on, chat. These are nice evenings, you know, there's always a lot of banter. And we walk out and, you know, everybody's leaving the exit. And he walks over to one of them and immediately starts snogging her. Right? Now, he had no way.
Now, hang on. For the American audience that have no idea what that means.
Started
for
making
snogging,
out.
Read making out.
Yeah,
there you go.
They were making out. And like, there's no way he had any interaction with her, you know, like it was, there's no way. I saw him all night, and then they just walked off into the distance. And this my boss, the chief executive guy, he says, that's it, I'm sacking him now. I said, why? He says, it's humiliating. He's humiliated all of us without exchanging a word. He's humiliated all of us. I said, Ricardo, look, it's been a great evening. You know, Lenny was great. You know, like, do you want to, like, give yourself, you know, bad blood? Because, like, listen, that's his thing. You know, like, no, look. I said, look, we feel the pain. We all feel the pain. There's no way in God's good earth this makes any sense. But it's happened. We saw it. Let's reflect on it. And tomorrow morning we'll take a decision. I just wanted to get past the fact. He was going to go up to him in front of the girl and say, don't come in tomorrow. You know,
right.
You know, like, you can do it just thinking about these days. But anyway, so the next morning, this is the pressure bit of it. He gets called into a meeting between me, the chief, and then the head of marketing, who was even nastier than Ricardo. And they said to him, I can't say his name. He said, so like you think you're a good promoter, a good marketer. You think you know what you're all about. And they say to him, are we having a good moment just now in the charts? He says, yeah, we're dominating the charts. We're all over the place. Heavy rotation everywhere. Oh, really? Heavy rotation? Well, here's your wheel of fortune, they say to him. here's your Wheel of Fortune. You know the old radios with the dial?
Yeah.
They say, you're going to go from the start of the dial and all the way through. And if there's not one of our songs played by the time you get to the end, hit the bricks. And like, even for me in those crazy, crazy days, I thought that was extreme. But
yeah, no kidding.
Yeah, so like it starts, and like we were dominating the charts at the time. So he should have been fine. He should have been okay. Quarter goes, and he's turning the dial. It's not anybody else. He's going really, really slow.
I bet he is.
And he gets halfway through, and there's still nothing, and you can see the blood draining from his face. You know, and a little bit more. And finally the Backstreet Boys come on with about 10% of the dial left. And like, I felt so good for him. So like we walk out, he's saved, and he says to me, were they serious? I said, I think they were. He said, but why? He says, look, you can't do that. You know, like, I don't know what the secret is, you know, it's your thing, but you can't do it in front of the other guys. It's just not going to work. So, like, no, and he says, yeah, I get that. I said, but anyway, how do you do it?
Listen, we all know if he had that secret, there's no way he's telling you.
Well, he did, but I mean, it's too vulgar, the version of it. He did tell me what the secret was.
You have to tell me that one off air.
I'll tell you off air, but I swear to God, it's so just basically simple. You know, he said you need to communicate to them, even at a distance.
No, listen, I know you, and I don't want to go down this road because I know where it'll lead. Let's save this one for off air. Although it sounds to me like we've got the makings of a new podcast here, right? Roger's Tales from the Music Industry. This could be
that would be one.
The more salacious offering.
That was well.
Let me get back on track.
What's yours,
I'm going to start with an own goal. I've actually got a couple of own goals this week, and no goals. It's been that kind of week.
Is that just the world we live in?
Well, actually, my second one is one of each. It's an own goal and a goal, but we'll get to that shortly. My own goal, I have to say it, is Bryson DeChambeau, and not just him, but the kind of golf media. I'm going to throw them into this as well. Now, anyone that's been following golf has, like me, been bombarded with Bryson DeChambeau stories. I mean, he has been just about the only story since the PGA Tour came back. And, you know, in the lockdown, fair play to him, and no criticism of this, he's worked really, really hard at bulking up, and he's a mad scientist anyway, and he did the math, and he figured out that if I bulk up, I can do this, I can do that, and if I can maintain my flexibility, I can get extra yards off the tee. And by God, has he done that? I mean, he is hitting the golf
ball.
How has
he done that? What is it? Amino acids? Is it steroids?
Well, look, who knows, right? Who knows? I mean, yeah. I'm sure. If I don't know what the performance enhancing drugs policy of the tour is. If they have one. I know there was a big thing about beta blockers back in the 1980s because they lowered your heart rate and supposedly made it putting easier, but there was a big fuss around Nick Price and that back in the day. But I don't know what their steroid, et cetera, policy is, but I can guarantee he ain't going to be difficult to find if you want to do some testing. But look, fair play to him. He is hitting the ball 370 yards and hitting pitching wedges into par fives.
Oh, for goodness sake.
And he's been, I think, top 10 in every event back. He just won this last one. So the 18th hole was almost a 500-yard par four, and he hit pitching wedge into it.
That's ruining the game.
So he's, well, look, you can say that, whatever. He's still got to hit it straight, and is it ruining the game? They said this about Tiger back in the day. I don't know. But what happened this week was he hit a bunker shot, which didn't go where he wanted it to, and he had a churlish fit and swiped at the sand with his golf club and threw the club and, you know, had a bit of petulance. And
sounds
the cameraman
like
who was... Well, no, but in fairness, DeChambeau had some expectation of hitting a good shot, so he was disappointed. For Giles, it's just the repetitive nature of it that makes him do it, I think. But the cameraman, I mean, it's the PGA Tour and there's no crowd, so the cameraman's following him.
Of course.
And he basically fronts up to the cameraman and says, you know, basically, man, why are you filming me? Why are you showing that? You're really showing my brand in a bad light. You're spoiling my brand. And he got really pissed off with the cameraman, which is just pathetic, right?
Well, I mean, you know that is a side effect. You know that.
Well, yeah, well, I actually posted a tweet and I said, is this roid rage or is he just a douche? And the
all right, okay.
And the replies
bang
came
on,
back
bang on.
Pretty much split down the middle.
Oh, really?
But it's just, look, it's just ridiculous. And his comments were, in his interview afterwards, which is what caused the most outrage, in his interviews afterwards, he was basically, instead of saying, oh, you know, I'm really sorry about that, I'd lost my head, he was basically complaining about, you know, people spoiling his brand and they shouldn't be doing this and, you know, we have a bad moment and then you ruin our brand because of it. Kept talking about his brand. And he said, you know, if you meet me, I'm not too bad a guy. And I just remembered that great Margaret Thatcher quote, which was, about power. She said, it's like being a lady. If you have to remind people that you're a lady, you're probably not.
Yeah.
And it's the same, right? So, yeah. So that for me was my, and when I talked about throwing the golf media into it, I'm so sick to death of the coverage of Bryson DeChambeau. I mean, every time he hits the ball, oh, he's hit it so far. We get it. Just stop fawning over it. Stop telling us that every time he comes under the camera shot, you're telling us how far he's hitting it, about his workout routine. We can see. He looks like a cartoon character now. Yeah. He really does. He's got this sort of thin waist and tiny legs. And
putting the boot in. I saw him. Did you see the posting?
Yeah. I did. I saw plenty of them. But look, Eddie likewise gives him his props for what he's doing. I said, look, it's amazing what he's doing. But look, I mean, if you're that guy, go for your life. It depends. Do you want to be a winner? Or do you want to be, you know, thought of a decent human being? I mean, I know which way you'd go.
Yeah.
But anyway, that's my first own goal for the week.
Great own goal. Well, I'm going to follow up with my own goal, which, listen, you know, we can probably put them all in the same macro theme. Let's try and wind them all together here. So you've got the wonderful bonuses that the FIFA executives paid themselves in those years. These are enormous numbers that were paid to Blatter, Jerome Valcke, the head of commercial and the finance director. We're talking seven-figure numbers, big seven-figure numbers. You know, at the time where I always say that, you know, the people that pay for the whole game often, you know, are the ones that are saving up to buy the new kit for the kids and, you know, leaving 150 behind every time they go to a game because, you know, the food and the train and everything like that. And these guys who, you know, let's be honest with FIFA, they make their money by getting the free use of somebody else's asset, i.e. the players that are paid by a club, and making billions in television revenues and then living the grand lifestyle. So, you know, you get that and then you fast forward to post-Blatter and you've got the story coming out of Switzerland where the mate of Infantino, the prosecutor, Lauber, has now been investigated by the Swiss government because they think he's been like leaving certain things uninvestigated. And you know, then you go forward to the amazing story of Wigan, you know, and in theory, a club being sold by a good owner to chance or charlatan owners who use the club basically as a tool to win their bet on the club getting relegated. I just think that, you know, we've seen it with the podcast with Jerry Cardinale and Gary Sweet. You know, there's both of those people talked about the need for balance and respecting the fan. You know, I think football is in a moment where it's really struggling with this just now. And I see rips all over the place. You know, you look at Germany and the ultras there with the 50+1 rule and they've got in their sights the Hoffenheim guy that spent money to do what they... So I just think, you know, the grassroots of the game, you know, the ultra fans and then the excesses of the game at the other side, I think they're getting further apart, Grant. And, you know, somebody needs to come in, you know, with proper... Well, we've said this all before, let's not get on the soapbox about governance and everything, but, you know, that guy, those people in the Caymans, the gamblers in Singapore, they should never have passed a fit and proper test. Never, ever. And, you know, you've got Rick Parry on a video saying, well, I suspected something was coming out of the Philippines, a big bet. You know, I can tell you in the corridors, people have these conversations, and we know that some of these things are super dodgy, and we just get on with it because, you know, there's another game up near the weekend. It's a big game. Let's concentrate on that. I think the game's in danger, Grant, is what my own goal is of the week.
Yeah, the Wigan story was extraordinary. If anyone isn't familiar with it, then just Google Wigan Athletic bankruptcy. In a nutshell, it was bought by, I think, Hong Kong-based investors.
Initially, right? Yes, initially.
Initially. And literally within weeks of buying it, they put it into administration, blaming COVID. And, of course, the penalty for a club being put into administration is a points penalty, which at this stage of the season would essentially see Wigan relegated. And it then came out after the fact that there had been a huge bet placed on Wigan to be relegated. And so the story goes that these guys basically bought the club to win the bet. Now, I don't know. I haven't seen the smoking gun yet, but it's an extraordinary story. The FIFA stuff, look, from what I've seen in my lifetime, there is nothing about FIFA that isn't bent. From the top down, it's a filthy organization. It just always has been, right? And probably because of exactly what you identified, Rog. There's nothing at stake here, right? They're selling bottles of water to people crawling around in a desert who will pay anything for it and are desperate to have what they've got. And they don't have to do anything. And so, of course, the billions that are coming in, they feel like it's down to them. Of course, it isn't. You and I could go and do the kind of deals that Blatter and those guys did and do it cheaper because we wouldn't want to take the huge backhanders that those guys took. It's an organization that's rotten to the core. The sad thing for me is that, you know, after all the hard work done when Blatter was taken down, a lot of hard work that was done, incidentally, by the Americans. I mean, the Europeans didn't really affect it the way they should have done. This was an American-led investigation. It's sad that we're, I don't know how many years, 4 or 5 years on from that.
Yeah, at least.
And you know, we're not seeing people in jumpsuits carted away to prison. These people seem to have lives like cockroaches, and they survive and they come back and they get back into football somehow.
Yeah.
I mean, it's extraordinary to me. And when you think about this must be about the power they exert over the organization, over the clubs, you do wonder what it would take to break that power, given the fact that these people are surely as vulnerable as it's possible to be. How do they find themselves back in these positions of power? I really don't know. It speaks to the kind of backhanders that are obviously still going on, Rog.
Well, it's the democracy of these organizations that they get elected and empowered by the member associations, not the clubs. And, you know, if you think about some of the people that have been in charge of some of the federations around Trinidad and Tobago, America, all over the place, to be honest, then they're going to elect somebody that's going to understand their way of operating and facilitate their way of operating. So, anybody that comes in and, you know, let's say somebody of good faith came in and said, look, I've got a serious problem about the FA of Serbia. I honestly think they're not doing the right thing for the family of football. You go in there and you try and do something, then they start saying, well, if you touch that, the specificity of sport, you can't do this. Maybe Serbia won't play the World Cup. Politicians get involved. You know, it's almost impossible to make any change there because of the way that the democracy is set up. But my point, Grant, is that I sense that a little bit like in the real world, the proper world, where you've got populism coming, I sense this is happening in football. And I can feel it. I can feel that whether you call them the ultra fans, whether you call them the grassroots, I think they're had enough. You know, and the smart move for the power in football would be to speak like Jerry Cardinale or Gary Sweet. Even if you don't mean it, just, you know, take a little bit of the heat off, a little bit less excess, just get through this bad moment. But I sense they're not going to be smart enough to do that, and I don't know where it all ends up.
Yeah, I agree with you. It feels like there a moment is either here or is close at hand where if you're in that situation, you say to hell with it. I don't care if Serbia won't play in the World Cup and the politicians get involved. I'm going to do it because I think the fans will back me.
Exactly.
I think I'll have grassroots support. I mean, it feels to me like that moment, as I say, if it's not here, it could be not too far in our future. And you can only hope, I guess, Rog, that when that moment presents itself, you have someone in power with the balls to actually step up and do that and say, to hell with it. I'm just going to go ahead and do what's right and see what happens.
Yeah.
Because, you know, when you look at, going back to finance, you look at the Wirecards of the world and the Luckin Coffees of the world getting exposed, all these frauds getting exposed, suddenly it becomes a cool thing to do to start exposing more of these things. And so suddenly people want to be the hero who brings this stuff out into the sunlight. So hopefully we get to that point in football and more journalists do the kind of work that a guy called Dan McCrum did at the FT,
yes,
to expose Wirecard, you know, the things he went through. And if you're not familiar with that story, just Google Dan McCrum and the Wirecard story, and there's a video online that, with him talking about
astonishing
what he went to expose the story. It is, it's amazing. But
you know, I've heard that, you know, obviously the major issue there is that the German investigators gave him a super hard time. Well, they sued him. Yeah.
The regulator sued the FT and McCrum personally.
Which is disgraceful. But I've heard, and again, you know, I love conspiracy theories, so I may be wrong on this, but I heard some of these investigators, their stuff, Epstein had stuff on them. And you know, that's how they control.
Oh, come on.
I read it, man.
Oh, come
that,
on.
You know, they were told to let it go.
Oh, sweet Jesus. You're crossing the streams, Rog. You're crossing the streams.
Yeah, let's leave that one.
Definitely cross the streams.
So, but before we leave football and that bitter note, let's go back and all start celebrating, because we have to say something. You know, if let me give you, you know, some numbers. If you start playing football, professional football at 18, and you score 330 goals a season for 22 seasons, you end up with something like 650 goals, right? Messi has scored 700 career goals now. You know, and he's still young. He's not 40, you know? So, you know, he hasn't played for 22 years. I mean, like, are we aware of who we have seen over these last years playing the game, Grant?
Well, hang on a second. Coming from someone who has, on this podcast, more times than I can count, put Messi beneath Maradona, that's saying something. I mean, do you realise what you've seen? I think Messi's the greatest I've ever seen. And I saw Maradona in his prime. I think Messi just is without peer. I mean, he's just unbelievable. And yes, you're right to bring that up. It's an extraordinary statistic.
Extraordinary. 30 goals a season average. You know, like, nobody scores 30 goals. Ian Rush scores 30, you know, like... You know, like, and the serial
Bob Latchford.
Yeah, but it's just it's
once.
Yeah, once. Astonishing. And it shouldn't pass without people, and I'm not sure the young ones maybe realise, but you know, they've had Messi and Ronaldo at the same time, and I think this isn't a normal era, Grant. You know?
No, and if you think about it, if the young kids who've grown up around Messi, for them, Rog, scoring 30 goals a season is normal now. I mean, look, and Messi does it every year. What's the big deal about scoring 30 goals a season? When he's gone and the top scorer gets 20 again, people are going to think football's in decline. That's the sad thing.
Possibly. But anyway, Lionel Messi, well done. You know, you've given us a huge amount of joy. I still think in terms of the bigger picture, and you can't really, it's an intangible, you know, he's played for a team that was set up to win. He got most of his career with two or three other absolute outliers in Xavi and Iniesta, and I would even put Piqué into that. Diego went to teams that never won anything, never won the summer beach tournament, and he made them win the Scudetto, and then he won a World Cup on his own. His stats don't show that, but in terms of swimming against tides, I still think Diego has it.
All right, well, that's your prerogative, my friend. As you say, it's an intangible. We can never do it. Actually, while we're on the subject of football, we ought to also tip our caps to the Scousers for winning the Premier League finally after 30 odd years of, well, relative hurt for them, I suppose, not hurt for anybody else. But look, I mean, Liverpool have thoroughly deserved that title, and good that they won it on the pitch and didn't have to get it awarded to them. I've seen the games back. Obviously, Man City put four past them and absolutely waltzed all around them. But I mean, that was an outlier. Having watched them against Brighton last night, they look very, very good, and they look like they're going to be good for the next couple of years. So, you know, well done to Liverpool for winning that title. And I think English football again is going to have two, and possibly with a resurgent United and then past Chelsea, maybe three or four really high quality teams for the next two or three years, which is an exciting prospect.
It is.
Right. Well, my other own goal, which is a goal for one person, and that is the celebration on July the 1st, which has become known in America as Bobby Bonilla Day. Now, Bobby Bonilla was a baseball player for the Mets. And on Monday, July the 1st, age 56, he was given a check by the Mets for $1.2 million, a check that he gets every July the 1st from 2011 through 2035, which is absolutely amazing. So $1.2 million, 24 years. And this all stems from the year 2000, when the Mets said they were going to buy out the remaining $5.9 million. He had just under $6 million left on his contract. But instead of ponying up the $6 million at the time, the Mets decided they would make annual payments of $1.2 million for 25 years, including an 8% interest rate, which they negotiated. Now, anyone listening to this is going to think, you're out of your mind. What a ridiculous, who on earth would make that deal? And this is where the story just gets, A, fantastically intricate, and B, so representative of everything there is to say about the Mets organization. It's perfect. The Mets thought they'd actually cut themselves a really good deal.
How?
Yeah, and I'll tell you why. Because that $5.9 million, they had invested in something that was promising them double-digit returns over the course of the deal. So they would have made a significant profit had they not invested that $5.9 million with Bernie Madoff. Unfortunately, they had invested the money with Bernie, and we all know what
joking.
Happened there. No, I'm not joking.
Hang on, Grant, let me play this back, because maybe I've not got this. Right, okay, so because there's two elements to this here. Bernie Madoff was guaranteeing pretty much, 15% a year? You know, it wasn't...
It was compounding.
Okay, but even so, like, somebody listening to this can do the spreadsheet. 6 million at 15% doesn't get you to 25 grand. It doesn't get you to 25.
No, it doesn't. But don't forget that this would have been... I'm sure that their thing was going to run longer, Roger. They weren't going to expire at the same time. It was going to run longer, and they figured out that this is the way they could do it.
Somebody must have had a backhander there, Grant. There's possibly. No way that, I mean, what kind of fucking discount rate were they using? 70%?
You are clearly not familiar with the New York Mets. Do a little bit of digging into the New York Metropolitans, and you will find out a little bit more about how typical this is of the organization. Something I probably shouldn't say, seeing as one of my closest friends, manager.
Yeah, well, we just had Jerry on, and like, this is an organization that's going to be sold for two big ones with a B, big ones, to everybody that wants to buy them. So they can't be that messed up, Grant.
Well, no, but the Mets are to the world what AS Roma was to Jim Pelotta, right? They're the other New York baseball team,
right?
And everyone looks at the Yankees and sees what they are on a global basis and thinks, well, surely the Mets can be the same. But the Yankees had Steinbrenner, and the Mets have had a procession of disastrous general managers. But that's the interesting thing. And here's why this turns
and then
into
Madoff. Unbelievable story.
But here's why this turns into a goal. And this is for Bonilla. Obviously, that was a goal. Now, he actually has another deferred contract plan with the Mets and the Orioles that, beginning in 2004, pays him another $500,000 a year for 25 years.
What?
So on top of that. So he's getting 1.7 a year for 24, 25 years, which is, God bless him. But there are other examples. There's a guy called Brett Saberhagen, who's a pitcher. He gets $250,000 a year from the Mets for 25 years. Beginning in 2004, a guy called Max Scherzer gets over $100 million from the Washington Nationals.
No, there's something
runs
seriously
between
wrong
now
here.
And 2028.
Oh, I mean, this
Manny
is
Ramirez
basic,
for Red Sox. He gets 25 million over the
finance
next
spreadsheets,
5 years.
Discounted cash flow. I mean, like, that's these aren't difficult. You know, like, what are these organizations thinking? Explain it to me. How can you pay an annuity that is four times what you would have paid if you just paid it up front? I mean, like,
you're the CPA. Listen to this. So the final one was a guy called Bruce Sutter, who baseball fans may have heard of, Atlanta Braves fans may have heard of, but people that don't know much about baseball who will have potentially heard of Bobby Bonilla or Manny Ramirez won't have heard of Bruce Sutter. He signed a deal in 1985 with the Braves, and he was going to get paid $750,000 a year while he was with them. And then for 30 years after he retired, he'd receive at least $1.1 million a year.
Oh, my God.
So, well, this is just, I guess, trying to get around the salary cap or front-loading it, and we're going to pay you a little bit now, but we get a chance to make it on the back end by investing it, blah, 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 blah. So he got paid $750,000 in 89 and 90 because he retired with 2 years left on the six-year deal he'd signed. So the 30 years of $1.1 million didn't start until 1991. So he's got, I guess, one more year of that, and then he's going to be in the poorhouse, the poor fella. But I just thought that was a great story, and it says a lot about the Mets. I love the fact that Bernie Madoff was involved in it, it just tickled me, I have to say.
Well, you know, maybe I've made a mistake in life in not following American sports closer.
Right.
You know, because, like, there's obviously a level of craziness that I had underestimated. And I'll dovetail that amazing story of yours. That is an amazing story, Bernie Madoff. Yeah, I mean, like, you just keep making that up.
But it's like Michael Caine at the end of Italian Job. Hang on, lads, I've got an idea.
So I saw on Twitter the other day this clip that just stopped me dead. There's this quarterback who gets the ball, and, you know, he's in the pocket and he's getting squeezed by the linebackers, and he just fucking starts running. Michael Vick.
Oh, yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
Like, I'd never seen that. I'd never seen that.
Oh, you hadn't seen it?
No, I'd never. I said, well, that's not what a quarterback does. I mean, like.
Oh, no.
I mean, then I start, this is the funny thing. Then I start saying, who is this guy? You know, and I look at Wikipedia, and you know, it's a great story where the headings are called earlier controversies.
Right.
You think,
yeah, how long before they got
after?
Into the dags? The dags.
So, like, yeah. give the listeners a little bit of.
He turned into Brad Pitt from Snatch, is basically what happened.
I mean, so yeah, you read these earlier controversies in Wikipedia, and you cannot make them up. I mean, there's everything in here. There's, like, stealing the watch at the security at the airport.
Yeah.
I mean, like, please go onto Wikipedia, Michael Vick, earlier controversies, and, like, it's a really fun 10 minutes.
Follow the story through. Yeah, look, but, I mean, look. As a quarterback, what a talent he was. I mean, there's an ESPN 30 for 30 documentary, two-part, just called Vic, which was put out only a couple of months ago. I guess at the beginning of lockdown they put that out. And it tells the whole story, and it's him in his own words telling the story.
Jesus.
But look, when you see the footage of what he could do on a football field, and you listen to his teammates and opponents talk about it, I mean, he was a truly extraordinary talent. I mean, he really, really was. And when you read the Wikipedia stuff and you see how his career hit the skids and why it hit the skids, it's such a shame. You know, when you look at Bo Jackson and you see a talent like that, you see a career like that trashed because of injury, it's bad enough. But when you see a talent like Vic's, you know, like Maradona, right? Who it was personal demons,
yeah,
and inability to kind of understand what he had. Embrace it, make the most of it, and then fine, if you want to steal watches and have dogfights, do it after you've retired, not now. But he's an amazing athlete. It's an incredible story, and the ESPN documentary, if you can find it, so it's called Vic, is
the
well
world
worth
is
the time.
Crazy, and maybe it's always been crazy, but, you know, it just seems that everywhere you look now, it's just like knockout stuff, you know, just knockout. I saw something the other day, bubonic plague is
in China.
Yeah, I mean, Jesus, I mean, like, Unbelievable. Anyway, I think that's us, Grant, is it not?
Well, yeah. I mean, I'm assuming the rapture is next, Rog. You give me a call, won't you, if you know the rapture's due?
Yeah,
you let me know,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, yeah. No, but honestly, I mean, you just everything you look, you know, like Kanye West, you know.
Yeah. Well, I have to say, given what's happening, it would almost be the perfect bookend were America to end up with Kim Kardashian as the first lady.
First lady, you know, it would be wonderful.
When you look at that and you think, wonderful. You know what, it's probably what the world deserves right now, frankly.
So it just came out, it just came in my timeline, you know, because it's these things that you scroll past them and there's a delayed reaction as your brain says, what? You know? So, like, you know, I'm just scrolling down. Kanye says he no longer supports Donald Trump. He's taking advice from Elon Musk and Kim will be the first lady. And you just think, you know, this is Sodom and Gomorrah. You know, like, they really should just all come now. Noah, you know, the whole, you know, let's just start again.
Well, look, I mean, you want to start worrying if he taps up Vanilla Ice for VP. I think that would be potentially a problem.
Kanye.
Jeez, what a world. Anyway, Rog, I guess you're right. I guess that just about wraps us up for this week. All that remains, as always, is to thank you for listening. To make one request, if you wouldn't mind taking the 2 minutes it takes to rate and review the podcast on iTunes, that really, really helps. It helps us move up various charts and makes us easier to find for people, which in turn helps us grow the audience. So do take the time if you wouldn't mind. We would greatly appreciate it. Follow us on Twitter at EntertainedR, that's A-R-E the word. You can follow me on Twitter if you're not already, and you wish to do so, at TTMYGH.
And you can follow myself at RPM Como, as in the lake.
As in the lake. Roger, my dear boy,
thank
it's
you,
always
sir.
A pleasure.
Thank Let's you. Take care of yourself. Bye-bye.
See you, mate.
Bye.